Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at the Cure Panel, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to Cure Panel's first show on fertility and reproduction. This is Cure Panel's 66th episode. And our distinguished guest on the show today is Dr. Musa Shimonki. Dr. Shimonki will help us understand the risk factors for infertility in men and women and answer related questions from our panelists and audience. Dr. Shimonki is Director, In Vitro Fertilization and Assisted Reproduction, David Jeffin School of Medicine at UCLA, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Shimonki has published numerous papers and has won several awards, including the Carby Award for Excellence in Obstetrics and Gynecology, the Patient's Choice Award, and America's Top Doctors Award. Welcome to the show, Doctor. My co-host for the day is Shweta Mishra. Shweta is a biochemist, nutritionist, and a diabetes educator who is passionate about research and writing on medical and scientific issues, of which fertility is close to her heart, being a survivor. Having gone through the pains and emotional upheavals of infertility, she aspires to help people dealing with infertility by educating through her research, discussions, and writings on this issue. Supporting Dr. Shimonki and Shweta on the panel are experienced and knowledgeable infertility survivors and advocates, Fran Meadows, Kimberly Logan, and Brava IVF Mama. I extend a hearty welcome to all panelists and to all our listeners. Today we are discussing infertility. Where does it stem from? Risk factors for infertility in men and women. Mayo Clinic defines infertility as the inability to conceive despite having frequent unprotected sex for at least a year for most people and 6 months if the woman is above 35 years of age, or inability to carry a pregnancy to live birth. According to the 2006-2010 National Survey of Family Growth, CDC, 1 in 8 couples, that is almost 12% of married women, have trouble getting pregnant or sustaining a pregnancy. Even though many insurance companies still do not cover the cost of infertility treatments, the WHO, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recognize infertility as a disease which impacts millions of lives around the world. With the hope of giving hope to those going through the pains of infertility, in the coming hour, we will try to explore the reasons and provide our audience with valuable information. So stay tuned. At the end of the discussion, we will be addressing questions sent in by our participants. I will now hand over to Shweta to begin with the discussion. Shweta, you're live on air.
Thank you, Priya. Thank you so much for a wonderful introduction. Dr. Shimonki, I welcome you to the discussion, and I thank you for taking time from your busy schedule today to help us understand this issue of fertility and the risk factors behind it. Welcome to the show, Doc. Infertility can be a very painful experience and a roller coaster of emotions and feelings which kind of remains with the person dealing with it throughout life. And even if even after he or she has been fortunate enough to have been cured of it, but unfortunately not many people come forward to talk about it, and this is due to the stigma that is attached. So I'm really thankful to the Cure Panel Talk Show to provide us with this platform to start fertility and reproduction, and also appreciate the panelists for joining us today to share the story and facilitate the discussion. Dr. Shimonki, I would like to begin by asking you, what are some of the very common risk factors or causes of infertility that you have seen in your practice?
Well, thank you again for the very kind introduction. There are many risk factors for infertility, the biggest and the most obvious of which is advancing maternal age, meaning simply a woman as she gets older, that aging process is a known risk factor. You may have seen it multiple times in movies, people bringing up the biological clock. This is actually based on an accurate assessment of what happens as women are aging. So the most obvious is female age, and especially as a woman gets into her mid to late 30s and certainly by her 40s, she will have a greater chance of being infertile. But there are many other causes as well. In the woman, there could be issues with the tubes. If a woman has had a pelvic infection, if she's had abdominal surgery or a ruptured appendix, gilosis, all these things can damage the tubes and prevent a spontaneous or natural pregnancy. There could be issues within the uterine cavity, fibroids projecting into the uterus, into the cavity of the uterus, or polyps growing within. That can also be a cause for infertility. And then when you look over at the male side, any abnormality with the sperm, which can be very easily detected with a semen analysis, can also be causative. And in fact, 15% of infertility is solely due to a male cause, and up to 40 to 50% there's some associated male cause. So it's definitely, it can be from both sides.
Okay. So you're saying that the maternal age is the biggest factor. I'm sure our panelists and many of our audience have the same kind of question about age of men as well as women related to infertility. But my question next to you is that in my case, my doctors always wrote secondary infertility on my papers. Can you explain what that is and how it is different from primary infertility? Because
sure.
In my case, even though I conceived my first child through naturally, but it was only after 1 and 1.5 years of trying, and then I miscarried. So still, is that a case of secondary infertility? How is that explained?
Sure. Thank you for the question. So the term primary infertility refers to a woman or a couple who have been trying to conceive where there's never been a pregnancy. So if they come in having never had a pregnancy, that is defined as primary infertility. However, if a woman has conceived, even if she hasn't necessarily delivered a baby, it still is relatively loosely defined as secondary infertility, meaning she's been able to get pregnant before rather than never been able to get pregnant. And that's the term secondary infertility.
Okay. So in my case, it was a secondary infertility, even though I conceived first, right?
That's correct. So because you had a pregnancy before, when you came in presenting with infertility, because you had conceived before, it was defined as secondary infertility. Now, the term is relatively unimportant whether it's defined as primary or secondary. If the bottom line is you're not getting pregnant, you know, a thorough evaluation can often discover the cause of the infertility, and most often there is a treatment available for it.
Okay. My next question to you is regarding tuberculosis as a risk factor for infertility, and I would like to give you a little bit of my clinical background with the battle with infertility. So
sure.
My husband and I dealt with the loss of a natural pregnancy after about 5 years of marriage, and then we unsuccessfully tried to conceive again with assisted techniques for the next 5 years. And finally, now in our 10th year, we are in our 7th month of pregnancy, which was IVF assisted, of course. And it was one natural conception and early miscarriage before we got 3 IUIs done with Clomid and 1 failed IVF in which 3 embryo transfers were done. And then I was also on AKT4 treatment for about 9 months for tuberculosis. And I was only diagnosed with tuberculosis after my first failed IVF in India. And then after the 9 months of AKT treatment, one of the very famous doctors in India told me that if you have had tuberculosis in your life, your chances of conception by IVF goes down even further. And the doctor suggested me to go for a surrogacy. So I want to ask you, have you observed this in your practice too, that the patients after TB diagnosis have reduced chances with success of IVF? And are there any peer-reviewed studies backing this thing up? And if that is true, what may be the science behind that?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say congratulations on your ongoing pregnancy. And I'm glad
to hear
that you did not give up and that you decided to do an IVF cycle rather than go on for service.
Yeah.
There is data, and much of it is from many years ago, that looks at women who have been exposed to tuberculosis and reproductive outcome, including with IVF. And indeed, there is a reduction in outcome related to having had a history of tuberculosis. And it could be multifold. It could be due to many things. It could be due to damage to the uterus. It could be due to infection and damage to the tubes. There's some evidence that women who have been exposed to tuberculosis produce fewer eggs with an IVF cycle stimulation. And so there's been multiple reasons why women don't do as well if they've had tuberculosis in the past. The most important thing is to treat it, and once it's treated, reevaluate the person and see if, you know, they still have adequate egg numbers and their uterine cavity is normal and the lining appears to be developing normally, then I would still attempt to conceive with either less aggressive fertility treatments or IVF rather than jump to donor egg or gestational surrogacy, which is what you did, and I'm glad that things worked out for you. In the United States, we don't see very many patients with tuberculosis, so my personal experience is limited. I've only diagnosed one person with tuberculosis in the United States. She was able to conceive, but it is pretty rare. We don't see it very often.
Okay. But my question is, if you are anyways trying to go with IVF, then how does it matter if the tubes are damaged with tuberculosis? I mean, that should not affect the chance.
Well, it can if the tubes are damaged at the ends, and the tubes are filled up with fluid, a diagnosis called hydrosalpinx, meaning fluid in the tube, literally. That's a situation where if you did IVF without removing the tube or at least separating the tube from the uterus, your pregnancy outcome is cut in half. However, if you surgically remove the tube that's damaged and filled with fluid, again, it's a very specific kind of tubal damage. It's the kind of tubal damage that's called a hydrosalpinx. If you remove the tube or separate it from the uterus, then your success rate goes back up to whatever your baseline chances are, and roughly double what it would have been had you left it there. So, but you are right. If the tubes are damaged but there is not a hydrosalpinx, then IVF is the correct treatment, and it wouldn't make a difference whether you took the tubes out or not.
Okay. And just a follow-up question on the ways in which you diagnose TB. I mean, I had serious doubts about the PCR technique. I mean, that technique defines that will show a positive result even if there is just one single DNA of the tuberculosis bacilli, right? So how do you know whether the patient is having TB or it's just showing false positives?
Prior exposure. Yeah. I mean, that can be very, very difficult. And certainly if someone has a positive TB test but has been treated in the past, then we presume, as long as they're not symptomatic, that tuberculosis has been cured. Now, if, however, someone has a positive tuberculosis screening test and has never been treated, and certainly if they have symptoms, especially if they're from high-risk areas or work high-risk jobs where they're exposed to tuberculosis, then the recommendation would likely be to treat. So it really depends on the clinical scenario.
Okay, so my next question relates to male infertility now. And it's very common to have, I think it's very common to have a low sperm count as a risk factor for infertility. But I also know that is not the only one, and men can also have high percentage of DNA fragmentation in the sperms that may be responsible for their infertility. Could you explain what DNA fragmentation means to our audience and how does it actually impact infertility? And are there some common factors that may trigger the fragmentation of sperms in the sperm DNA that men should avoid in their daily lives? Or is it just something which is kind of inherited and beyond one's control?
Well, you know, the one thing about the male factor infertility, which is what makes it so challenging, is that when you find an abnormality in the sperm, there's a high percentage of a chance that you don't end up with a good explanation for it. Yes, sometimes you find that they've had an infection or they have something called a varicocele or they have a genetic cause. but quite often you don't end up with a very good explanation. Thankfully, the fertility treatments are able to overcome the vast majority of any abnormalities with the sperm, because the treatments themselves either put the sperm in the uterus at a higher concentration, or in the case of IVF, you could actually inject one sperm into each egg to overcome a potential fertilization problem. So, with regards to DNA fragmentation, it's a bit of a controversial topic, because studies have demonstrated that if you do IVF and then you end up injecting the sperm into the egg, the process is called ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection, then it overcomes any issues with sperm DNA fragmentation, or at least that's what many of the studies suggest. DNA fragmentation refers to the sperm within the head, or rather the DNA within the head of the sperm, and normally it should not be what we call fragmented or broken up. And there is a test, or there are tests that you can do to evaluate the DNA fragmentation. And the argument from the urologist is if you have a high DNA fragmentation, you should do ICSI to inject the sperm into the egg. However, if you're doing IVF most of the time, a high DNA fragmentation is associated with an abnormal semen analysis, and quite often you would do inject the sperm into the egg at that point. So, it depends on what level of value you put into the DNA fragmentation. Many clinicians don't even get a DNA fragmentation, and I would argue that that's not necessarily a bad approach.
And are there some common factors that men should be aware of to avoid such kind of a thing, you think?
Yeah, again, this is such a difficult topic, because it's hard. You can have a man who's incredibly healthy, exercises regularly, eats well, and has a very poor semen analysis and possibly high DNA fragmentation. And you could have someone who doesn't eat well, doesn't exercise, uses illicit drugs and has a normal semen analysis. It's hard to know. However, the general mantra is, try to avoid any potential toxins. So you avoid excessive alcohol, avoid smoking, avoid drug use. You want to try to exercise and eat a healthy diet full of antioxidants, leafy green vegetables, fruits. You take a multivitamin a day. Those things will at least maximize the environment to allow for normal sperm production. Remember that sperm takes at least 70 days from when it's formed to when it actually is ejaculated. So what a man does to their body today won't be evident in their sperm for 2.5-3 months later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Doc, for your answer. And now I think it is time for our panel session. So I now invite our first panelist, Fran Meadows, who is an infertility advocate and an author. I request Fran to introduce yourself and give us a little bit of your background and your battle with infertility, and then share your questions or concerns with Dr. Shamonkey. Fran, you're on air.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Dr. Shamonkey, for being here, and Shweta, thank you for having me today. Again, my name is Fran Meadows, and I am an author of The Truth Behind the Secret, Infertility. And through my experiences, I became an infertility advocate, raising my voice in the community to, raise awareness for infertility and, to show other men and women they're not alone. And, there are so many resources out there, and there's so many people out there that are looking to help people conceive, like doctors like Dr. Shamonkey. And, I was silent through my journey, so it was very difficult, and that's basically why I turned to journalizing and then setting forth to write my book. So it helped me heal internally by not speaking out, and now obviously I'm on the other side. I am now a mom. My son is 6 years old, and he was conceived through IVF. Going through that experience, I suffered a devastation of a late pregnancy loss at 25 weeks pregnant. So, I kind of went through the ups and downs like most people do with infertility. And, now I'm basically in the community, raising awareness and, sharing resources with patients and, connecting with other professionals in the community, online and through, educational things like this. And, live events. So that's basically who I am and how I became part of this community. Not that it's something that somebody wants to become part of, but it is a very supportive community, so I think it's a great thing that you're doing with this radio and this panelist and, you know, having an expert guest today. So that's basically who I am. And I do have a few questions for Dr. Shamanki, and I will begin with sharing my experience. My husband and I, we were diagnosed with unexplained infertility. Now, I know each patient has a unique issue and different risk factors. After testing, the results come back normal. How difficult is it to determine why someone was diagnosed with unexplained infertility? And you as a doctor, do you find it harder to find a protocol for treatment for patients with unexplained infertility?
Well, Fran, first of all, I'd like to thank you for coming on the show and sharing your harrowing story and eventual success. And I appreciate all the questions you'll be asking. So,
thank you.
Yes, unexplained infertility is a big challenge, and it affects about 15% of couples that we evaluate. The challenge, because we'd love to be able to tell a patient, well, we know exactly the reason why you're having difficulty conceiving. And it's frustrating, not only for the patient, but for the physician to say, you know what, I don't know. I have no idea what's going on. I've done all the tests that we are capable of doing, and I still don't have an explanation. I can guess as to the reason why you're having difficulty conceiving. There could be a fertilization issue. There could be a higher percentage of your eggs that are genetically abnormal. But, you know, to be able to pinpoint, give an exact answer, eludes us, and that can be a very frustrating thing. The good news is that even in the case of unexplained infertility, if a woman or a couple are willing to go through the treatments, often starting less aggressively and moving up to IVF, even considering something more aggressive than that, their fertility is often restored. They're often able, very often actually able to conceive and have a baby, as what has eventually happened in their case.
Wonderful. Okay. And I mean, like with unexplained infertility, as a doctor, is it difficult to actually give that diagnosis to a patient? Because do you feel that you're giving them less of a sense of what's going on? Because, I mean, in my case, I felt like I'd rather them tell me there's something wrong than not
right.
tell me anything and make me think like, okay, you know, maybe it's this. I mean, I had no underlying medical issues. They did find out that I had a thyroid issue. My husband had, you know, low sperm counts some days, and other days it was fine. So they didn't really determine male factor. And then I had,
okay.
like, cervical polyps. So, I mean, there's other things, I guess, that can contribute to the factors, but it's not determined because the testing was done. So is it difficult for you as a doctor to say that to a patient?
Great question. I've actually never been asked that before, but now that I actually think about it, it's not difficult, and the reason why it's not difficult is because I'm still able to guide a patient that will likely succeed. So, you know, if I was giving a diagnosis where it was a devastating outcome and there's nothing we could do, and unexplained infertility was that devastating outcome, then yeah, I'd feel pretty bad about it. But thankfully, even when you give that diagnosis, which is a frustrating one, no doubt, when you're told, I don't know what the cause is, the good news is that fertility treatments can overcome the vast majority. And so that, if there is a silver lining in all of that, it's that.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Thank you. And also, going on to my next question, most young women, when they have their monthly menstrual cycle, they might think that they're supposed to feel, you know, bad cramping, heavy flow, and other pain associated with their menstrual cycle. With technology evolving in the field of reproductive medicine, are there simple, non-invasive tests or procedures that can find things like endometriosis or PCOS earlier than later?
Yeah, that's a great question, but the most non-invasive would be like a transvaginal ultrasound, where you could evaluate the ovaries and look for polycystic ovaries, for example, in the context of a story where a woman is not ovulating and has other signs and symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome, such as acne or increased hair growth. Well, in the case of endometriosis, if you do an ultrasound and you see, look at the ovaries, and there's a big cyst in the ovary that is consistent with endometriosis in the ovary, and they have a story of pain and let's say, infertility even. And that would be a good story and a good relatively non-invasive approach for diagnosing endometriosis. However, in the case of endometriosis, unless you have an ovarian cyst where it's obvious, the only way to diagnose it would be to do laparoscopy and actually take a look. Sometimes you can do a tissue biopsy. In the case of polycystic ovarian syndrome, it's more the story. If someone doesn't ovulate, therefore doesn't have regular or predictable cycles, and they have those other things. 9 out of 10 women with polycystic ovarian syndrome are overweight. Most will have some evidence of what we call hyperandrogenemia, where they get acne, increased hair growth, and we can detect that with blood work as well, where you'll see increased testosterone. There isn't a great non-invasive way. You know, there isn't like a saliva test that says you have endometriosis or polycystic ovarian syndrome. It involves taking a careful history from the patient, doing a careful exam, and an ultrasound. And that usually helps guide us guide the patient, rather, to the appropriate evaluation.
Right, because I find that obviously early education and early diagnosis is helpful for going to treatment, so you can guide the patient in the right direction.
Absolutely.
Okay. And Shweta, do I have time for one more question, or are we going to move on to the next panelist?
I think you can ask one more, and then we'll move on to Kimberly.
Okay, wonderful. Well, going back to when you and Shweta were talking about age, obviously we all know that age in a woman is a known risk factor. And,
sure.
You know, with the decline of the quality and quantity of their eggs, why do some doctors seem very fixated on age prior to knowing the diagnosis from results? Meaning, like if I came in and I was, let's say, 38, would you hear my age and kind of like start thinking like, okay, it's her age? You know, like because I find a lot of doctors from hearing other people's experiences, when somebody goes in with, you know, an age in their, you know, middle 30s, doctors are kind of telling them that it's probably your age before they even know anything.
Yeah, I think any physician that doesn't look at the full picture and take a full history and do a careful exam and ultrasound, I think any doctor who projects to the diagnosis before doing those things is doing their patient a disservice. So it's unfortunate that any patient has that experience where before even a careful ultrasound and a careful history, a simple look at their age automatically, you know, leads to the answer. Now, there are some pretty obvious times that that's the case. If a 48-year-old woman walks in and says, why am I not getting pregnant? It's probably that is most
right.
Certainly related to her age. But if someone's in their mid-30s, that should not be the first thing that jumps out of the doctor's mouth. It's interesting. I kind of get the opposite response where the patient will come in their mid-30s, and I'll say, oh, you're so young. And then they laugh at me, saying, what are you talking about? I'm really old. So I tend to get
because they probably had a doctor tell them something differently beforehand.
that's certainly possible. Well, you know, there's no doubt that there's more and more awareness about age, female age is having an impact on fertility, but by no means should anyone be tunnel vision to thinking that's the only diagnosis. I'll give you an example. Any physician that's been practicing long enough gets burned by assumptions. And you know, I had a couple come in that there was a known severe male factor, and it was like very low sperm count. They needed IVF. This patient was only 31. And I was like, oh, this is going to be a slam dunk case. You get sperm, you do IVF, you do ICSI, and this couple will have tons of embryos. They'll get pregnant very quickly. Until I did the ultrasound. When I did the ultrasound, she had very poor, what we call ovarian reserve, very few eggs left. And helping her conceive was a huge challenge. Eventually, it worked. They have a beautiful baby boy. But it was a lesson I learned in assuming that I knew the answer before I did the exam. And once I did the exam, I came out saying, you know what, guys, there's a lot more here than I would have expected. This is going to be a greater challenge than I thought. And it was. And thankfully it worked out. But yeah, it's always important to keep an open mind, and it's always important to do a thorough evaluation before jumping to conclusions.
Right. Well, thank you for your honesty, and thank you for answering my questions. I'm sure we're going to be going on to the next panelist. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Fran.
Thank you, Fran. Our next panelist is Kimberly Logan, who is the founder and president of REI Connections. Kimberly, please let us know in brief what REI Connections is. functions is, and also share your fight with infertility briefly. And I know you have a very, you have some very exciting questions related to lifestyle that I'm sure many among our audience also would like to know the answers to. So please go ahead.
Thank you so much for the introduction. My name is Kimberly Logan. I'm the founder of REI Connections and IVF Center Solutions, which is kind of a spawn from my journey through infertility back in the 1990s. My company staffs infertility centers throughout the U.S. And Canada, and we do a lot of patient outreach and advocacy just to make infertility patients feel like they've got a living room to come into to talk about infertility, to see us in social networking. I went through infertility back in the 1990s, starting in 1993. Much like Fran, I lived in silence. It was, bottom line, a private hell. I was 29. I had my life planned out. It was going to be perfect. I was having my first child by 30. 6 months into trying, nothing was happening. Went to my OB, and like Dr. Shimonki said, when you have a young patient, you're looked at differently. My OB told me to go home and try for another 6 months because I was young. No worries. Mm-hmm. The alarm bells were going off at that point. I'd had an unplanned pregnancy in college, so I knew I could get pregnant. My insides told me that something was not right. Turned 30, went back to the doctor, diagnostic workup, phone call, and the music stopped there. Severe male factor. One of the worst sperm counts I've ever seen. Ever. Choices were adoption or IVF. And we chose IVF. Again, we were severe male factor. The point in time, if you went back to, you know, the early 1990s, ICSI, which Dr. Shimonki spoke of earlier, was available in Belgium and parts of the U.S. 1995, did our first IVF. Devastating results, no fertilization. We ended up going on a wait list up at Cornell University. It was a 1.5-year wait list. Got into St. Barnabas, did IVF with ICSI, successful. Had my first child. A year later went back and had my second child. Now I crunched 3 years of hell down to a couple of minutes, but it was a crawl, it was a battle, and it was hell. And as I tell you the story, it seems like it was just yesterday. So many more advances have been made in this ever-evolving area of medicine, and I'm just excited to be part of it.
Right. Any other questions to Dr. Shimonki?
Yeah, the questions I have is, because it was severe male factor, again, back in the 1990s, we didn't have what we know now. Male factor has always been there, but there was so much there is now anyway, you know, your healthy lifestyle. Are you going to do yoga, acupuncture? You're drinking green tea. You're doing all the right things. You're taking the vitamins, and it should be just kind of a slam dunk. And then on the flip side of it, my question is the people that do drugs, drink alcohol, they smoke, prescription drugs, illegal drugs, it seems like the ones that have the lifestyle that's not so clean get pregnant. And the ones that have, like, the uber-clean lifestyles, it's like, what am I doing wrong?
Yeah, those are great points. And the answer is the people that have the clean lifestyle are not doing anything wrong. And most often, the cause for severe male factor is unrelated, not in all cases, but in most cases, with lifestyle. Because even if someone, unless someone is under severe stress and doing some really awful things to their body, they're still going to have sperm. And then, you know, again, someone, how can you explain when someone is healthy and fit and eats right and doesn't have a good sperm count? And the problem is that's what makes male factor, the diagnosis of a male factor, much more challenging for a reproductive urologist than, for example, what I do in evaluating women, where there are very clear and obvious tests and answers. So, for example, if you do a hysterosalpingogram and the tubes are blocked, well, there you go. That's your answer. Or if you do a semen analysis and it's severely abnormal, well, there's your answer. But for a reproductive urologist evaluating the male patient with a severe sperm problem, it can be very challenging. And so to answer, I don't know if it was more of a statement or if it was a a question, Kim, but yes, sometimes you would think you know the answer and it sounds like it's going to be a slam dunk, but in reality it can be quite elusive. I happened to do my fellowship actually at Cornell well after the days that Gianpiero Palermo was recruited there from Belgium. He's the person who wrote the first ICSI paper, and it was kind of a funny story. When I got into fellowship, my co-fellow was Dr. Palermo, because he had decided to do an OBGYN residency and then a fellowship.
Wow, that's
and
great.
So I was one of the two fellows, and it was pretty funny and fun, actually, to have him as my co-fellow. This was back in 2002. So, yes, ICSI has revolutionized the way you treat male factor, because what was at one point very difficult, if you had a severe male factor problem, even if you did IVF, you could get what you had, which is failed fertilization, without ICSI. The alternative at the time was donor sperm. But with ICSI, where you inject one sperm into each egg, that overcomes most male factors. So, yes, it's really
revolutionized the whole male factor fertility, but because, point in time back in the 90s, it was a weird twist of fate. My sister called me one night, and I'm like, oh, here we go again. She's going to tell me what to do to get pregnant. And she said she was watching this show on, like, 2020, and it was this scientist from Belgium and this brand-new technique for people that failed IVF. I'm like, okay, now we're on to something. But at that point in time, again, it's historical.
Right.
It was a
right.
wait list. I mean, I live in South Florida. You would have to sit on wait list for 1 to 2 years in hopes they'd pick you. And that's
right.
We did. We were on the wait list at Cornell for a long time, and then some upheaval in the industry, and then we ended up at St. Barnabas, and that's where I did my treatment. But at that point
right.
in time, it was constantly chasing the sperm count for a male, and that's got to be frustrating as a doctor.
Yeah,
I
can only imagine it was so much more frustrating at the time when there really was no alternative other than using donor sperm. So I'm glad things worked out for you. No doubt you had quite a challenging time as well, and I'm glad things worked out.
Yeah, it was crazy. And my other question, also relative to style, weight and body mass index. When I went through my journey, I'm 5'10", I was 115 pounds. Obviously, I was nervous under a lot of stress, so I was thin, but, you're underweight. No, I'm not underweight, I'm small bone. Does weight play a role, overweight, underweight, for women and men, just women? I know there's PCOS, overweight. How does that all really play into the dynamics of infertility?
It's a great question. When a woman is, and again, what is an appropriate weight for one person may not be an appropriate weight for another. So remember that this is relative on a per-woman basis. That's where body mass index comes in play, because it takes height into account, not just the weight. So it's height and weight. The body mass index should be in the range of about 19 at its thinnest or at its lowest to about, before you become technically overweight, about 25. And then obese is about 30. And so as body mass index gets to the extreme, so super, super thin or significantly overweight, that can affect the way one ovulates. So you're, instead of having and by the way, if you're having regular menstrual cycles, that means you're ovulating about 97% of the time. Regular.
Oh, really?
Yes. So regular cycles being defined as 21 to 35 days. So if you're somewhere in that range and it's coming regularly in that range, you're likely ovulating. But when you get to the extremes of that body mass index, your cycles can stop coming. And that alone can affect your ability to get pregnant. But beyond that, if you do get pregnant, there can also be greater issues with pregnancy loss, so egg quality and pregnancy loss, in particular if someone is significantly overweight. And so, and if someone is significantly underweight, there's the issue with nutrition for the growing. It's important to be in that range, ideally in that 19 to 25 range, and not much above that if possible, because in doing so, you'll be maximizing your chances for ovulating and for fertility.
Interesting. So if you had a patient that's, say, 350 pounds and a patient that's 99 pounds and you're given the same dose of infertility drugs, would it have a different effect if they're out of range? Like, would it be as effective?
Well,
as many eggs?
If someone was dangerously thin or dangerously overweight, I actually would not be attempting to help them get pregnant, but rather help them correct the issue that's leading them to be severely underweight or severely overweight. And then while after doing so to at least a certain degree, get them into a safe range, then I would initiate fertility treatment. But fertility treatments can vary. And, you know, what is appropriate for one patient may be not appropriate for another. And there's so many variables that go into that, it's hard to really answer that question.
Okay. And then does it matter on the male side, the weight or body mass index?
Yeah. Great question. Again, probably less so, but there's no doubt that if a male is severely underweight or severely overweight, there is a likely reduction in sperm count, probably for the same reason. The signals from the brain to the testis to form sperm will cease to be there, kind of as a body's safety mechanism. You know, the body shuts things down that are, quote-unquote, unnecessary or dangerous. So, for example, if someone is severely underweight, the brain perceives that as a form of stress and, you know, lack of nutrition. Oh, I can't get pregnant right now. So it'll shut down the hormones of the brain to the ovaries to stimulate ovulation. So it's a protective mechanism, and that's what happens.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you see people in all sizes and shapes, and it probably isn't one size fits all, but you see people 300 pounds that have a lot of children, and you have women that are, you know, 75, 80 pounds and they have children, but somewhere in between is probably the right median that we want for fertility.
For the vast majority of people, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for your great question.
Thank you, Kim. And next we have a Brave IVF Mama on our panel joining us from Northern California. Brave IVF Mama, would you like to share your story with us briefly and then ask your questions?
Certainly. Thank you for inviting me to be on the panel, and thank you, Dr. Shimonki, for taking our questions.
Absolutely.
So I have another crazy journey. It took us 5.5 years to have my son, who's now almost 19 months. We started, went off the pill, started trying to get pregnant, didn't happen, saw a doctor, kind of got the, okay, come back in 6 months. Ended up doing 5 cycles of IVF using my own eggs, 2 of which were canceled, 2 of which resulted in miscarriages. Switched to a different doctor for the last cycle just to try a different protocol. And I don't respond well to stimulation drugs, so we never got very many embryos. And by the end, after the 2 miscarriages, we were doing genetic testing to make sure the eggs and the embryos were normal. We ended up deciding to use donor eggs because we were 5.5, you know, at that point, 5 years in, and just not willing to keep throwing the dice over and over and over. And the donor egg experience was actually great. We ended up doing 2 cycles with our donor. My son is the result of the 3rd embryo from the 1st cycle. We got 3 genetically normal, physically great embryos from that cycle. And then we did another cycle with her since we knew we wanted siblings, at least a chance for siblings, and got 8 perfect embryos out of that cycle. My diagnosis was unexplained for a long time, and then we found some immunology issues that led us into treating those issues. And to Shweta's comment, I'm actually one of the rare Americans who does have latent tuberculosis. So as part of all of this, I had to go through nine months of INH treatment before using so that I could do Humira to calm down my immune system. But I guess my first question is really about reproductive immunology. It's something that some doctors believe strongly in, some doctors, you know, think is a load of nonsense, and many doctors sit in the middle and think there's some science there, but it's still, you know, bleeding edge. And I'm interested in how you see that field of, ART.
You ask quite a challenging question. By the way, congratulations on your family, and you express, you know, in talking about using donor eggs, a really valuable option that many women and couples will not consider. But I'll tell you, in my experience, when it is the appropriate choice, meaning if someone, for example, in your situation where it really was rolling the dice and you're really hoping one normal egg in the rare amount that you produce, where, you know, that's a scenario that can be very challenging. And when you move on to donor egg, where donors are generally young and you get plenty of eggs, of high quality that yields beautiful embryos, which yields a beautiful baby, it's a very rewarding choice. And so I commend you on making that choice. It's not an easy one, but it's a great one.
Thank you.
Now, you do ask a very interesting question. My dad was actually a reproductive endocrinologist, and he was actually the first fellow in reproductive endocrinology at UCLA back in the 70s. And in the era that he was trained and then evolved, reproductive immunology was extremely popular. And there were many, many patients being treated with, Humira wasn't around at the time, but with IV immunoglobulin therapy, and it was thought that this is definitely a strong cause for infertility. However, when you look at the data over time, when people have looked into, you know, large populations with, you know, potential immunologic issues or evaluated certain things like if you have high or low natural killer cells or, you know, various things like that, the data have not actually panned out. There is no good evidence to suggest that, I'm not saying that this doesn't exist, but on a large population basis, the data have not panned out to demonstrate that there's a clear causative effect, and more importantly, that there is a clear benefit to any of the treatments. So even if you find an abnormality or what is perceived as an abnormality, that the treatments will ultimately yield a viable pregnancy. And so you do ask truly one of the more controversial questions. And, you know, I'll tell my patients these things. And, you know, clearly if there's, you know, have I used things like this in the past? Yes, but it's the evidence has led clinicians, you know, in the direction of, you know, there really is no clear evidence that, A, these abnormalities are causative of infertility, and, B, any treatments actually help at all, on a large population basis. Most of the clinicians have kind of steered away from them just because they're not considered standard of care. Now, again, are there individuals that might be helped? Yes, but for example, if you don't mind me commenting on your story, and I only know the superficiality of it, I don't know the details, but in someone who's had, you know, what is described as poor ovarian reserve and moved on to donor egg, there's no doubt that treating tuberculosis is important, and you may need Humira for an important reason, but the most likely reason why things have worked out for you is the use of a donor egg rather than necessarily immunologic treatments. Now, I'm not saying that immunologic treatments didn't help, because, again, I don't know your story, but on a large population basis, there's usually another explanation.
Thanks for that perspective.
Absolutely.
One of the topics you touched on briefly with other people was ICSI, and one of the things that made IVF sort of swallowable for me was the idea that I was taking out variables. And ICSI is obviously one way of removing a variable, that this, you know, can the sperm fertilize the egg? And genetic screening is a way of removing a variable. And for me, moving to donor egg was a way of removing a variable. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what those options are, since there's probably people listening who don't know about all of the different variables that are controllable? I mean, ultimately, there's still some chance involved, but IVF and various techniques can really help remove some of the variables if you know they're a problem or if you suspect they could be a problem.
Absolutely. Really great question. So in a scenario where a woman is undergoing IVF, and this is a process by which you give medicines to make the ovaries produce generally many eggs, but often whatever eggs the ovary can produce at that time, and that range can be anywhere from 2-3 eggs, two, ideally more than that. If someone has a lot of eggs available, you don't want to overdo it. But you want to aim for a range of 5 to 15 eggs to retrieve. Normally the body only releases one of those eggs when it ovulates. IVF takes advantage of, you know, the fact that there are many eggs available quite often, and we use medicines to make those eggs grow. But anyway, so you take those eggs out. And one IVF overcomes one potential variable, which is each egg has a, let's say, X percent chance of being normal. Let's just make that chance 5%, just for argument's sake. Well, if you get 5 eggs instead of 1, then your chance goes from 5% to 25%. chance that one of those eggs is normal. If you get to 20 eggs, then it's 20 times 5, and that's near 100% chance that hopefully one of those eggs is normal. And so IVF and the stimulation related to it by producing many eggs can overcome the what we call aneuploidy, or the rate of eggs being genetically abnormal, because eventually you're probably going to get to one that is normal, and the more you get, the better odds you get one that's normal. But beyond that, when let's say you have a couple who has unexplained infertility, we've been talking about that. Well, what if it is a fertilization issue? Well, to overcome fertilization, you could do ICSI, reinject the sperm into the egg, to overcome a potential fertilization issue. You know, oftentimes couples, you know, either don't want ICSI or are torn between, you know, okay, yes, I do want to overcome any fertilization issue, but I really prefer to have an egg that's fertilized, quote-unquote, naturally by the sperm. Well, in that case, you could actually split. You could do some eggs naturally and some eggs ICSI, and if they fertilize with both techniques, then you know that if you ever had to do IVF again, you probably don't need ICSI. However, if only the ICSI eggs fertilize appropriately, then you do. Then you've diagnosed a probable fertilization issue. So ICSI is one way of kind of eliminating the male factor variable. Donor egg, as you mentioned, eliminates the poor egg quality variable because donors are generally young, and the younger a woman is, the better odds that they have genetically normal eggs and more of them. And so, for example, if a woman is 43, she may, you know, not produce more than 3, 4, 5 eggs with an IVF stimulation, and there's a very, very high likelihood that all of them are genetically abnormal. However, a woman who's 25 is very likely to produce, you know, dozens of eggs, and a very high likelihood that, 40-50% of them are normal. And so there's, you know, that's a way of overcoming an egg quality variable. IVF overcomes a tubal variable because you're bypassing the tube. So these are examples of kind of correcting for overcoming these variables that might be preventative.
Great, thanks. I suspect that's pretty helpful for some of our listeners.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure.
Another topic that hasn't come up that I just was interested in your perspective on is egg freezing. There's obviously been a ton of press around fertility preservation and egg freezing if, you know, you're not quite ready to have kids or you don't have the right partner, but you want some chance at future fertility and a future pregnancy and baby. Can you talk about how you think about that? Are there particular risk factors that might suggest egg freezing is a good, a good approach? Is it more of a business right now than an actual medical industry? What's your thought?
Well, again, great questions. Any industry can be fraught with abuse, and so when egg freezing initially came out, the success rates were not very good, and I was vocal about telling my patients to be cautious to adopt it as, you know, a first line or something to go right to, just because the outcomes at the time were, you know, not very good, and it was considered experimental. Now, things have changed as time has evolved, and as the techniques have markedly improved the freezing techniques so that the vast majority of eggs that you freeze thaw and survive the thaw perfectly and retain whatever they would have been before freezing, the ability to fertilize, it's become a much more viable option. Certainly there's a significant expense to the patient. It can cost thousands of dollars to freeze eggs. However, if a woman knows, let's say she's 30 years old, and she knows, I mean, barring some unforeseen things, that she's not going to have a baby for another 10 years, then she would be, for example, an ideal candidate to freeze eggs. Why? Because at 40, you have a very high likelihood to be infertile, and at 30, you're very likely to produce a good number of eggs, and many of which may be genetically normal, thereby truly potentially preserving your fertility. I tend not to like the term fertility preservation only because there's a sense that it's a guarantee. But unfortunately, it's not a guarantee. So a woman may freeze 20 eggs and have none of them be normal. And ultimately, when she uses them in the future, it may result in not having a viable pregnancy. And so I make sure, I counsel my patients not only about the pros of doing egg freezing, which are, you know, you might indeed freeze your ability to have create a pregnancy in the future, but also the cons. It's expensive. There's a chance that, A, you never use the eggs because you have no problems conceiving, or B, you decide not to have kids, or C, you do use those eggs, and unfortunately, they do not yield a viable pregnancy. However, the younger you are that you do it, the better the odds are that you've preserved an egg or more that are genetically normal that will lead to a baby.
Great, thank you. I don't think I have more questions, Shweta. I think everything's been covered.
Okay, thank you so much, Brave IVF Mama. Those were great questions. And I think we have a couple of questions from our listeners, and we had many more from which we got via email. But Dr. Shumanki, over the time, answered many of them. But one of the questions that I have received from one of my friends, I really wanted to ask that. She has PCOS, and she had the couple had five miscarriages, and none of her pregnancies went beyond 8 weeks. And their doctor don't seem to get to the root of the problem. So I just wanted to ask you, Dr. Shumanki, is this type of infertility very common, and are these problems of recurrent miscarriages due to some genetic abnormality or mutations that has been found to be related to infertility?
Great question. Recurrent pregnancy loss is a very frustrating thing to have because it's almost like it's a tease. You get pregnant, but it doesn't work out. Then you get pregnant again, and then it doesn't work out. And, you know, sometimes discovering the cause can be very challenging. Sometimes it's really obvious. Sometimes there's a known genetic abnormality that can explain the recurrent miscarriages. Sometimes there's an obvious autoimmune cause. And sometimes there's a defect with the uterus that can potentially explain the losses. And so it's important that any patient and couple have a very thorough evaluation. Now, in cases where there's no explanation, in most of those cases, it's due to a genetically abnormal embryo that's stuck. And in most cases, when a woman is releasing a genetically abnormal egg, the egg will either not fertilize or not implant. But in the cases that they do, the vast majority will miscarry. There quite conceivably may be some women who have produced these abnormal embryos that are more likely to stick than other women. And so most likely, in cases where it's unexplained, it's still due to a genetically abnormal egg that was ovulated and then fertilized. So occasionally it can be the sperm too, but it's more likely to egg that then became an abnormal embryo that happened to stick. And again, nature's way of protecting you from a bad outcome is that embryo will miscarry. Now, the good news is that in those cases, still, the likelihood for the next pregnancy to be normal is quite high. Now, so for example, if you had a couple losses, you probably have a very high chance, over 50% chance, that your next pregnancy will be a viable pregnancy, it will be a healthy baby. The more times you have a miscarriage, though, that percentage will go down. But even after your fourth or fifth loss, your chance of having a baby with your next pregnancy is still somewhere around 40% to 50%. And so, you know, just because someone's had multiple miscarriages does not mean that they should give up and does not mean that they're not going to be successful in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it is very important that they have a thorough evaluation. That's the most important thing.
Right. Okay, I think we are almost nearing towards the end of the scheduled time for the show, but I want to ask one question which has been sent through the email. What is the science behind stress and depression affecting fertility?
You ask a very challenging question to finish the show. Stress is difficult to measure. In fact, it's immeasurable. But there are studies suggesting that women that are experiencing high levels of stress do have higher rates of infertility. Now, whether it relates to the stress affecting ovulation versus affecting the implantation, it's impossible to know for sure. But there's there is evidence to suggest that stress can impact outcome. And, you know, one thing I tell all my patients is, you know, if you're in a very stressful environment, try to get out of it. If you need assistance, there are numerous support groups to help, as well as psychologists and psychiatrists, and if need be. And family is an incredible source of support, and, you know, surrounding yourself with family is important, and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to focus on things that you can control. So if you only focus on things you can't control, you're probably going to remain pretty stressed. But if you focus on things you can control, did I take my medicines? Did I do this correctly? If the answer is yes to all those things, I tell my patients only to think about those things and not to worry about outcomes, because no one on the planet can predict if things are going to work out. But what you can control is your actions.
Correct. All right. I think we have had a very informative session this hour, and the hour just flew by. Dr. Shamangi, I thank you so much for joining us tonight and answering our questions, and we look forward to many more such sessions in the future. And Fran, Kimberly, and Brave IVF Mama, thank you so much for joining us today, and it was really great to have you all tonight on the show. And now I will hand over to Priya to wrap up the talk. Priya?
Thank you, Shweta. Dr. Shamangi, it was an absolute pleasure listening to you, and I think the hour just flew past. And what an awesome discussion the panelists have been having. I'm sure the listeners have received a lot of information. And thank you, everyone, for your participation. The link for today's broadcast will be shared with all the participants within a matter of 24 hours. And please let us know what you would like to hear on the show. This is our new talk series, and we would really appreciate your feedback regarding what you want to hear on the show. And you can always mail me with any queries regarding the show at priya@trialx.com. And please join us on Wednesday, 16th of July, when we will be discussing invisible symptoms of multiple sclerosis with Dr. Vairi Singha. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Doc. Thank you all.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.